This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We now know a bit more about what next year's legislative session will look like. So today we're going to unpack it with not one, but two State House reporters. Our own Brandon Smith, thanks for coming in.
Happy to be here.
And Nikki Kelly from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Nikki, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Brandon, as long as we're talking about the legislative session, let's kick off with the news that we heard on Monday about House Speaker Brian Bosma's successor. He announced his retirement on Organization Day, also the day of the Red for Ed rally. Who's taking the mantle of House Speaker?
That would be Fisher's Republican Representative Todd Houston. He was, even before Bosma had officially announced his retirement, as the rumors circulated that this might be the time for him to finally step away, Houston was seen as one of the most likely replacements. Young, smart, in leadership in the caucus, well-respected within the General Assembly in general, a top fiscal leader, which is often where speakers come from. You often see speakers play a big role in the House Ways and Means Committee before they ascend to the speakership. And so Todd Houston checked kind of all those boxes. And he ended up being the only person who really went for the job. A lot of other people said, no, I'm not interested, or I'm not interested at this time. And as we found out from that press conference where they announced Houston, he was the only person who put his name forward in the private caucus meeting. So, Todd Houston is going to be the next Speaker of the House for at least a few months before the 2020 election.
And Nikki, it's a bit of a moot point now. One of the names, though, that were floated as a possible replacement for House Speaker was Matt Lehman of Bern, who's more or less the second in command of the Republican caucus in the House. He said very early that he did not want the job, so he wasn't a candidate for the position, and Todd Houston ran unopposed. But if he were and if he wanted it, would Monday's news have been any different, you think?
I mean, it wouldn't have been unanimous, obviously, but I think Todd would probably have still push through with that. I know Representative Lehman has some grandkids now and wants to spend a little more time at home. And so that travel back and forth being, you know, up in Northeast Indiana was definitely a major decision point for him.
Brandon, should we expect any style changes under Todd Houston's leadership of the Indiana House?
Sure, but I'd say we don't know what those will look like yet, because I don't think Todd Houston knows what those will look like quite yet. A lot of this you have to figure out when you're doing the job itself. But in terms of big shifts in the way that the House is run, no, we shouldn't. Or at least Houston doesn't anticipate we should expect anything different. He talked a lot in his press conference about the idea of stability, about how respecting the way things have been running for a really long time, even quite frankly before Bosma was Speaker, and just, you know, efficiency in the way that the House is conducted. And that's a lot of what the Speaker does. So will you see huge shifts? No. But it's a new person. It's a new personality. And it's less experience at the helm, too, because even before Brian Bosma became Speaker the first time back in 2005 and then certainly again in 2011, he came into that job with a lot of legislative experience. And Todd Houston doesn't have anywhere approaching that level of legislative experience. So there might be more rookie mistakes, perhaps, that you might expect, but it'll be interesting to find out in a year and a half or so, or whatever it is.
And Nikki, as we said, he ran unopposed. And the House Minority Leader, Phil Giaquinta of Fort Wayne, released a statement saying that he looks forward to working with Houston to ensure, quote, the House conducts a healthy and vigorous debate, end quote. We're, of course, talking about issues like health care, child care, and public education. How might that debate be different with Houston at the helm?
I don't really expect much difference. And again, we are talking, you know, a year and a half away. Like, this is such an odd kind of position we're in, talking about a speaker-elect who won't actually preside over a chamber, you know, substantively until 2021. But I don't see any major changes. He's, you know, been a leadership member in the House Republican caucus now for a couple of years and seems pretty on board with the goals and priorities that they've got moving forward.
And to Nikki's point here, it is going to be a little while too, and there will be two speaker elections essentially between that, because the way that Brian Bosma has sort of laid out this process is he's planning to step away from the speakership right before the end of the 2020 session, so in early March. So Houston will be formally elected by the full House. But then in Organization Day of 2020, so after the 2020 elections, they vote for a new speaker. That's every 2 years after a statewide election, you vote for a new speaker in a new General Assembly. And depending on how those election results go. Now, I don't expect Democrats to take the House, but if legislators lose their seats in primaries or if there's some sea change in the balance, could we see maybe within the Republican caucus a desire to go a different direction? I don't think so, but you have to acknowledge that that is a possibility.
Yeah, we're talking about formalities, but there could be some actual change if the curveballs are thrown,
I guess. That's right.
Yeah. What about Brian Bosma's seat? If he's retiring, who might represent District 88?
Well, Leah McGrath is the only one I am aware of so far who has put her name forward. She was a Fisher's deputy mayor before. She's now at a private company. So she has definitely put her name forward, and I'm sure we will see several more.
Yeah, that could be an interesting seat, though, because it has as many seats up in that area, northeast Indianapolis, up into Hamilton County a little bit. Demographics are changing up there. Quite frankly, Todd Houston will have a difficult race for re-election in his Fisher's seat. But I expected that Bosma seat 88 to go Republican again, but it should be quite a race, especially with the speaker not running again. McGrath is a Republican. We haven't really seen, as far as I know, we haven't seen Democrats like formally announce that I'm aware of. But that could be a popular one on both sides of the aisle to try and go after.
Brandon, what do you think the legacy will be of Brian Bosma?
That's difficult to – we could probably do a whole show on that, quite honestly. I mean, he's the longest serving speaker in Indiana history, so there's plenty to pull from, and there's been a lot of big pieces of legislation he's presided over. You're talking about daylight saving time, major moves, the Indiana toll road lease, right to work. Not just presided over, he basically helped create Indiana's school voucher program. RFRA, certainly probably not one he's thrilled to talk about, but part of his legacy for sure. The road funding bills.
I was going to say, on a non-issue based thing. One thing I will say that's very different than my first session in 99 is sort of the transparency. And of course, there's always, you know, improvements to be made. But we now have, you know, live streams of all the committees. We have live streams of the sessions. We have bills that are up pretty darn quickly, every amendment, every vote. You can see it all very quickly. And so that is completely different than it used to be and has all pretty much been under Brian Bosma.
All right, let's get to the actual 2020 session. While we're talking about Brian Bosma, again, he's not done yet. He's pushing for something next year that he was once opposed to. What are we talking about, Brandon?
We're talking about raising the age at which you are legally able to buy and smoke cigarettes and vape from 18 to 21. This has been something that health groups and the Indiana Chamber of Commerce notably have been pushing for several years, principally as a health measure. They believe that if you make it a little more difficult for people who are 18 years old to start smoking, there's data that shows that they are less likely to start smoking at all. Obviously, kids are going to smoke. They're always going to smoke. But the data has shown in other places that have done this that it does cut down on youth smoking rates and smoking rates in general. Bosma was long opposed to this, and the argument you'd often hear was, well, you're allowed to serve in the Army or serve in the armed forces, but you aren't allowed to buy a cigarette. And he pointed out when he announced that he was going to support this change that folks in the armed services have come to him and said, we don't want our recruits smoking. We don't allow them to smoke in training camp, in basic training. That kind of, I think, tipped the scales for him. And he's hoping to bring a majority of his caucus along with him.
Nikki, there are also proposals to increase the cigarette tax. How likely is that to happen?
It appears it's not likely at all. It seems like what they're doing is saying we're going to move forward on the age issue but tackle the tax again in next year when it's a budget year because you can talk about what we would do with the additional revenue, et cetera, things like that. So I think they kind of looked at the two and said we can do one but not both, and they've chosen the age.
And along those lines, they're also talking about creating a tax on vaping. I guess I wasn't aware there wasn't one. Brandon, how is vaping treated differently?
It's not. So obviously sales tax applies to cigarettes and vape products, but there is a special tobacco tax or cigarette tax on tobacco and cigarette products, and there isn't one on vaping products. There was a lot of discussion last session, again, a budget session, about how to do that, and they couldn't figure it out by the end of session. there is a philosophical argument here among those who don't believe anything should be taxed and don't believe vaping products should be taxed, as well as a like logistical argument about how do you tax it, how much do you tax it, where do you tax it, and by where I mean do you tax it when a person buys it at the store? Do you have it – the store – is it taxed when the store gets it from the wholesaler, that sort of thing? They couldn't figure that out last session. And to Nikki's point, it seems like they want to take a pass on that too until next year. Although if I were to pick one that's more likely to happen, it is the vaping tax because there's a disparity issue there. Cigarettes are taxed, vaping isn't, and some lawmakers have a real problem with that.
And also on the vaping tax issue, the Indiana Department of Revenue has laid out very clearly that it's going to take them a couple years to implement this, depending on how they structure it, because they are also going through a software kind of new system upgrade. So it might be best to get it, I guess, in law, but let the effective date be later.
Yeah, Brandon, are we talking about just the law catching up to this issue the way it has to on just about every other thing, and that vaping is just kind of new and fresh and the lawmakers just haven't really looked at it yet?
Yeah, there's a big part of that. I mean, honestly, if this were a state run by Democrats, we would already be taxing vaping products because there are some Republicans who are just opposed to taxes. So I think there's been more reluctance on that part. But also I think there's been a renewed sort of vigor around taxing them, in part because of all of the health issues we've seen pop up over the last year or so and the last several months as regards to vaping and particularly youth vaping. Because, again, those studies have shown that when you raise the price of, be it cigarettes or vaping, it's going to be a little less likely for young people to start.
Now, you two are closer to this than I am. But I've heard this, it's not a budget year. It's not a budget year excuse on a lot of things, including the Red for Ed argument. Is that a good enough excuse, or is it just them trying to push things off into the back burner?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. The fact is we do have a 2-year budget. And if they went in and opened up the budget every short session to, you know, reevaluate priorities or, you know, find new revenue or whatever, I mean, we would basically be doing a budget every year. And I don't think everyone or anyone really wants that, especially when it's a compressed time period in a short session. So, you know, you just can't give everything as much attention as it should.
Nikki Kelly from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette and Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting, both State House reporters. We're talking about the 2020 legislative session. Coming up, we'll talk about what Senate Democrats have revealed, and we'll also talk about the jail overcrowding task force. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Before we get back to our preview of the 2020 legislative session, I want to tell you about yesterday's show. We addressed the high infant and maternal mortality rates in Indiana and what's being done about it. We talked to women's health experts and the Indiana State Health Commissioner, Dr. Christina Box. You can find that wherever you get podcasts. We're back now talking about what lawmakers are planning for next year with State House reporters Brandon Smith from Indiana Public Broadcasting and Nikki Kelly from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. And actually, the first group to unveil their agenda for next year were the Senate Democrats. And among the things that they'll be pushing for is decriminalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana. Nikki, what do we know about this effort?
I mean, I think it's a continuation generally of their position in recent years. They basically just feel like we're putting too many people in jail for small possession amounts. Unfortunately, I don't think the Republicans are ready to go there yet. I think there's still some discussion that can be had perhaps on the medical marijuana issue, but I don't think they're looking at, you know, legalizing marijuana in any form quite yet.
The only thing that struck me about the Senate Democrats' position was, I mean, the Senate Democrats will put forward these policies and they're never going to get anywhere, particularly in the Senate when there's even more of a lopsided Republican majority. And they know that. This is a statement of their priorities. This is what they think they should do so that when they go out and campaign in 2020, they can say, this is what we wanted to do. This is what the Republicans wanted to do or didn't do. But the thing that struck me about the Senate Democrats on marijuana was it wasn't legalization. It was instead of it being a felony or a misdemeanor for possession of marijuana, for small amounts it would be an infraction like getting a parking ticket or a speeding ticket or something like that. that feels it surprised me only because that's like a compromise position. That's a nod to, well, we don't want to legalize it, but we also don't want to be putting people in jail for it.
It's also a great way to get the ball rolling. You know, you just kick open the door just a little, and then the next year it's not quite as difficult to go the next step.
Yeah, so that did strike me, though I agree with Nikki. I don't see it going very far.
What else have the state legislature tried to do with regard to marijuana before? It has not only been the Democrats pushing for things.
Yeah, that's been a relatively recent phenomenon, and it's mostly at this point relegated to the medical marijuana side. Notably, Jim Lucas, a Seymour Republican, who's about as Republican as you can get in the General Assembly, which is saying something. But he's come around on this issue, particularly, and we've seen that a lot from veterans groups too, who say our members, our veterans, want this as a tool to help them fight the various issues that they deal with, and we think that you should, you know, loosen the reins. And it's that pressure is going to mount too, as we see Illinois is about to go full legal pot. Michigan has got it. So other surrounding states are looking at it as much as
Ohio has medical. We're kind of surrounded.
Right. Yeah, we are almost a little bit surrounded, except for Kentucky, and that's often the case on a lot of issues, quite honestly. So they're going to be feeling the pressure every session from here on out until they do something.
Senate Democrats also announced gun safety measures as part of their agenda. Brandon, what do they want?
Well, they're focused on sort of – they've moved off – again, it strikes me as they're not just saying, you know, the typical, if you will, big liberal policies on guns. It's mostly about gun safety. So expanded background checks, certainly, which continues to be popular with the Hoosier public but not popular in the State House among Republicans, but also gun storage measures. You know, if you have a child in the house, you have to keep your gun stored, or you could face criminal charges if that gun got into the hands of the kid and something happened. We've seen prosecutors use different laws to address that in this state, but this would be a more explicit like directive in Indiana code about how that should work. Again, though, that's just not going to go anywhere. There is no appetite at the State House in the Republican caucuses to enact any sort of gun regulation measures. If anything, you will see the opposite direction. You will see them trying to eliminate or at least loosen gun regulations.
And so it has public support, as you say, but Republicans aren't going to let it go anywhere. Nikki, are Democrats putting this forward so that they can kind of campaign on it?
Well, sure. It's definitely will be an issue in some districts in the state. Also, I think in general in the House, a little more than the Senate, Brian Bosma has done really well at avoiding votes on any of these kind of smaller issues, whether it be – I mean, I know last year it came up that there was an amendment that the House Democrats put forward for a ban on assault rifles, essentially. And some of the – Republican caucus was willing to move forward on that. I mean, it was starting to, you know, they were like, well, that one we might be able to stomach, but not these over here. So it'll be interesting to see how much longer they can keep protecting their members on these sort of controversial votes, more in the House. The Senate will vote on any amendment. They don't play sort of games with is it germane or is it a bill pending or anything like that. They just vote on them up or down.
And another thing that the Senate Democrats are pushing for is redistricting. Nikki, can you elaborate on what they want there?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously we've been talking about it almost since the last redistricting 10 years ago. But they would like some sort of process that takes, you know, it out of the hands of lawmakers and puts it more in a bipartisan or nonpartisan commission that won't consider sort of political factors when they're drawing these. But they've waited so long now that it's just not going to happen. And they've just purposely, I mean, they've done that on purpose.
Yeah, Republicans have run out the clock.
Yeah. And depending on how far they would go, it would require a change to the Indiana Constitution, which takes, you know, a very long process. So now they can honestly get up there and say, well, sorry, too late.
Again, technicalities. But Brandon, do you think if those technicalities weren't in place that we could find bipartisan support for this sort of thing?
There is bipartisan support for redistricting reform. There has been for a while. Honestly, the bill to create a commission was written by a Republican in the House for a long time, Jerry Torr. Brian Bosma has supported it in the past. The problem has always been mostly the Senate Republican caucus, and that is unlikely to change anytime in the foreseeable future.
Let's get around to something that the Republicans are pushing for, doing something about high health care costs. Nikki, what do they want to do about this next year?
Yeah, this is a new one that's come up, I think. When they say, well, we want to protect people from high health care costs, you know, a lot of the federal talk is about having hospitals and doctors or whoever put the actual prices of something. If you get a knee replacement or something, you know, here's what our price is. Here's what it's negotiated for insurance. Here's the cash discount, so to speak. House Republicans or House and Senate Republicans here don't want to go quite that far, but they are pushing a sort of claims payer database where all this claims information would be funneled all together. And for instance, if you lived in Evansville, you could go and look up sort of the average cost for a particular procedure in your area. Now, you wouldn't know specifically what one provider charges versus another, but you could prepare for it. So I kind of see that as the healthcare industry sort of trying to give a little so that they don't get hit with sort of the big stick. So that'll be an interesting conversation that our state has not had before.
No, this really came out of nowhere a little bit to us. I mean, it has been a growing problem in Indiana. We've seen some reports in the last few months, in fact, that show Indiana's healthcare costs are among, if not the highest in the country, which has given a lot of people pause on both sides of the aisle for obvious reasons. To Nikki's point, some people are going to say this is a half measure. Is it a bad thing? No. But it's not nearly as far as a lot of people think they should go, a lot of healthcare advocates think they should go. But it's what the hospital association will likely be comfortable with, and that matters a lot.
So the healthcare industry, it sounds like, is trying to maybe get ahead of this. But these are big moves to add, you know, this hospital billing transparency and dealing with surprise billings. Big moves with a lot of players. Of course, the healthcare lobby is very powerful. But since Republicans are pushing them, I don't know, Brandon, is it pretty likely that it'll make it through?
I see something happening. More likely the database than surprise billing. Surprise billing feels like it might be harder to tackle, especially in a short session where that might be – I mean, logistically, figuring out how that would work.
Yeah,
might be
and
a little
surprise
more difficult.
Billing, just so people understand, it's like you go get a surgery. It's an in-network hospital, but suddenly you get a bill from an anesthesiologist who wasn't in-network. Like you can control who the anesthesiologist is in your surgery. So everyone agrees that the consumer should not be shocked or surprised with this out-of-network bill because they did everything they were supposed to do. The question is the sort of fight between the insurance company and that out-of-network doctor and how they come to a middle ground on what price will be paid to them. And so it's more of a should it go to an arbitration, should it be a flat fee, those kinds of things. So just real technical on that.
Before we kind of wrap up the session talk, I want to talk about jail overcrowding and the Jail Overcrowding Task Force, which released its report. I read it. It's not an easy read, but it's not a long read. Brandon, can you kind of take us through that? How bad is it in Indiana?
It's bad. It's really, really bad. There are some really shocking statistics. There's one that says a really large majority of people in – now, let's define what we're talking about here. This is not prison. So this is not for upper-level felonies. This is county jails. So these are the people who have misdemeanors or really low-level nonviolent felonies or who are waiting trial. And that's the really important part because there was a recent statistic, and of course I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but it is a surprising amount of people who spent more time in jail waiting trial than they were sentenced to at trial. So they actually spent more time waiting to get sentenced than they did actually being sentenced.
So once they get to trial, it's time served and they're out?
Not necessarily. That's discretion of the judge and things like that. So not necessarily, which is
– they could be found not guilty.
They could be found not guilty. Yeah, you spent 3 months in jail and then get found not guilty. Well, 3 months in jail and you don't have a job. You might not have a family anymore. It's wrecking people's lives. And Representative Greg Steuerwald, who's been one of the leaders on this issue, talks about it. He said it's not just fiscally irresponsible. It's morally irresponsible. So this is a problem that a lot of counties are trying to tackle. Some have it really bad. Some are doing things really well. And that's what this Jail Overcrowding Task Force tried to get at, was what's working and what can we spread to other counties to make it work in more places? And I have to say I was really impressed. This task force met only 3 times this year. It was set up by legislation in the 2019 session. And it met officially three times. The work went on between those meetings. And they came up with this, albeit not long report, but they came up with recommendations across like four or five subject areas that are divided into short-term answers and long-term answers. And we see a lot of task forces formed in the state on a lot of different issues. And it feels like most of the time it's like, well, here's some things you could do, I suppose, at some point in the future if you wanted to. Or let's just study the issue a lot more. This feels more substantive than that. And I know we are going to see legislation in the 2020 session to address some of these very specific recommendations.
And indeed, the recommendations took up half the report.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was predominantly about recommendations. It wasn't like, well, here's all the talking we did. No, it was like, here's the things, here's a little bit of what we talked about, and here's all of the things we want you to do about it. They're talking about everything from looking at pretrial release, which is instead of, you know, when somebody's arrested and charged with a crime, instead of just saying, oh, well, go to the county jail for however long until we get to your trial, it's being a lot more deliberative about should they even be in jail while they wait trial? Should – you know, looking at the facts of this person using evidence-based decision-making to say this person can probably be released and then – but for instance, if they don't, you know, show up to their trial, the penalty would get a lot harsher if they're found guilty, kind of thing. That's a cost-saving measure. They're also talking about using technology to get better at that. Something that Indiana has done over the last year or so is texting people who are awaiting trial or going through a trial. It has shown – we have seen the numbers get better in terms of them showing up for trial. Just because they're getting those reminders via text. And so using that a little more to make sure people show up and all of this – I mean there are a lot of different problems and a lot of different solutions to tackle this. It won't happen in 1 or 2 years that they're going to start working on it right away.
And they'll have to because some jails are busting at the seams and they don't have the money to build. And who wants to increase taxes to build a jail, that kind of thing. But, you know, they need to look at, you know, are these the proper bail amounts if they're keeping people in jail? Basically, we're just jailing a person to make sure they show up to court because they can't pay the bond.
Yeah. They're out there at the State House every day bringing us the news. Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette, thanks again.
Thank you.
And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith, thank you.
Always happy to come on.
We're now going to turn to our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting, Lauren Chapman. You hear her on Fridays on the State News Roundup, but today she's going to share something that she and our engagement team are working on to get your input on not only the 2020 legislative session, but also our other coverage, political or otherwise. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, how's it going?
So what are we working on here? What are we talking about?
Yeah, so we have this project called the Indiana 2020 Two-Way. So two-way, for many listeners, it's kind of a radio jargony phrase, but it's a one-source, one-reporter, intimate conversation to kind of get to the heart of a single issue from a single perspective. And that's kind of what we're hoping to do with this tool. So the Indiana 2020 Two-Way is both a texting group and a Facebook group, a private Facebook group, as well as some live in-person conversations about the issues that affect your community and, you know, how they're playing out not only in the heartland, but also at the State House.
So basically what we're asking people to do is engage with us to let us know what they want covered.
Absolutely.
Because we are a public entity and we kind of want your input. I'm talking to you, the listener.
Yeah. I mean, we are, you know, we all come from very specific experiences. And, you know, I'm from Indianapolis. I grew up on the West Side. And I just happen to be a white woman who grew up in Indianapolis. But my experience isn't the same as every other white woman in Indiana. And certainly isn't the same as every other person who lives in the state and makes up what a Hoosier is. So we need to hear from you in order to tell stories from different perspectives.
So what kinds of things might someone, I don't know, give me an example of what someone might write to us and say what they want covered.
Yeah. So every other week, we send out a new question on our text tool. So you're not getting bombarded by us.
It's every other week.
Every other week, you get a text message. And if you're on the Facebook group, we are trying to have weekly conversations about, you know, news and topics that we're already covering. So for example, last week, We had a question from our workforce development reporter. He's working on this story about employers who are reaching out to folks with drug and criminal backgrounds to try and re-engage them in the community. And so the question we sent out was, to reduce job turnover, some Indiana employers are offering leniency and resources around workplace drug tests for employers struggling with substance abuse. And so we asked folks what their opinion was of zero tolerance policies. And what we got back were actually a wide variety of opinions. Folks who are, you know, like, zero tolerance policy is, you know, a hardline stance that generally speaking has implicit racial bias. And then there are other folks who are like, no, we need to have zero tolerance policies in order to protect people in the workplace. And that's going to inform Justin's reporting as he finishes this feature.
And so how can people sign up for these texting tools?
I'm so glad you asked. It's very, very easy. All you do is text 73224 and you text the word elections. It'll automatically sign you up and then you'll start getting those questions every other week. Or you can find us on Facebook. You can find us by searching Indiana 2020 two-way. And two-way is spelled out two and then dash way.
Can I have the number again?
Sure. It's 73224.
And then text the word elections.
Text the word elections.
Okay.
And we're hoping to hear from people all across the state. So for the a few examples, we've gotten people from Fort Wayne, from Indianapolis, from all across Indiana. So we desperately need to hear from you.
Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer Lauren Chapman, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, my conversation about how South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg's presidential campaign is going with Adam Wren, who covers him for Politico. I'm Matt Pelzer. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. We've been talking today about the 2020 agenda and what it looks like for the Indiana legislature. Now we'll broaden the conversation to look at what we can expect in the 2020 presidential race with a deep dive into Indiana's own candidate, South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Joining us is Adam Wren, a writer in Indiana who's covered Pete Buttigieg along the campaign trail. And you can find Wren's work in Indianapolis Monthly and Politico. Adam, thanks for coming in.
Good to be with you, Matt.
Let's start with how Mayor Pete is doing right now in the 2020 race. This time last year, Buttigieg was the little-known mayor of South Bend, a city home to about 100,000 people. As it stands today, that same mayor is leading in the polls in Iowa. How do we account for a rise like that?
Well, it's a really fascinating political story, and I think one that, regardless of how it ends, we'll be talking about for a long time in Indiana and elsewhere. I mean, essentially, you have a story that would have been deemed as unbelievable in the writer's room of Parks and Recreation. just a few years ago, you know, Leslie Knope goes on to run for the presidency as, you know, the mayor of Pawnee possibly. So, yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, he's leading in Iowa, a state that is, you know, typically whiter and older than most of the electorate, which seems to be, you know, kind of his core constituency at the moment. He's leading in New Hampshire, another early white old state. And, you know, this is shaping up to be a long nominating contest between the Democratic candidates that really could go through the summer at their convention.
What do you think people are drawn to about him? What makes him stand out from the crowd?
When you talk to voters in places like Iowa, you know, one of the first things that they mention when you ask them that question is his intellect. You know, granted, there are a number of other smart candidates in the field, but they, you know, cite his intellect. They cite his Midwestern manner, his demeanor, sort of this Midwestern nice persona as something that they like, and they really seem to like sort of his Goldilocks policy proposals. You know, not too liberal, not too conservative, sort of right, just right up the middle. So all of those forces are kind of conspiring, as well as the demise or decline of other candidates, to really vault him into the top tier right now.
He's leading in the polls, but as we know, polls can be fickle. Look at 2016. There are candidates in the past who have gained a lot of momentum in Iowa and then quickly fell. What's your sense of the political longevity of his run?
Yeah, it's a good point. If you look at the last 10 Iowa caucuses, the leader in the polls in December actually went on to win the caucuses only 50% of the time. So the mayor statistically is in sort of a precarious position right now. But for the most part, when you look sort of in the crosstabs, there seems to be really good news for the mayor. For example, you know, if you look at the second choice pick of likely caucus goers, and that's an important metric because the way that a caucus works, if a candidate doesn't have a 15% threshold, you know, those people can be you know, won over by supporters of another candidate in a high school gym somewhere as this hours-long process unfolds. And he has a real well of support as a second choice pick as well. Also, if you look at his favorables, they're at the highest or near the highest of any candidate in the field. And so he has a lot of fundamental drivers that really seemed to spell good news for him. And if you look back at his run, he announced his exploratory committee in January. There really haven't been a significant amount of high-profile gaffes that would lead you to think that, you know, he's just going to implode at some point if he has a bad interview. There seems to be a lack of those moments. And so for all of those reasons and the fact that he has roughly, you know, $51 million that he's raised this year, all of those reasons make him someone who is likely to go deep into the primary process.
A significant concern around the viability of him gaining the Democratic nomination revolves around his single-digit polling in African-American communities. What has the campaign done to change that, if anything?
Just this week, they are spending $2 million in South Carolina. He's only the second candidate behind billionaire Tom Steyer to go up in the air in that state, which is a majority African-American, the first state like that in the primary calendar next year. They are deploying African-Americans who are from South Bend and, you know, are surrogates of the mayors into southern states, people like his Indiana state director, Ariel Brandy, who is part of Hoosier Women Forward, sort of the Democrats in Indiana's answer to the Lugar series that sort of tries to educate, you know, women, people who are interested in politics and give them the skills necessary to sort of climb the ladder and succeed. They're deploying people like her into these early states and sort of, you know, validating the mayor's record among African Americans in South Bend. So those, I think, are two or three really key things that they're doing to try to reverse this.
It's been a tough year in South Bend, to say the least. What do we know about what Buttigieg's relationship was like with the African-American community in South Bend?
You know, we know that really from the get-go of his time as mayor 8 years ago, he has struggled with African-Americans there. And I think, you know, he would say it's been a learning process. He fired his police chief early on. He fired his fire chief. Both African-American leaders in the community, people that the community were really protective of. They were seen as, you know, citizens of South Bend who really made good and did well. And, you know, Buttigieg sacked them. He was sort of the smartest guy in the room when he came into the mayor's office, and in some ways was sort of tone deaf to political realities on the ground. And, you know, during his time in office, the racial makeup of the South Bend Police Department, which is under his purview, became less and less diverse. It began to look less and less like South Bend. And so the mayor is sort of in a moment where he accrues all the benefits of being a get-it-done you know, mid-sized town mayor in the Midwest, but also has to deal with the challenges of that. And when the police-involved shooting happened earlier this June, you know, that really put a significant obstacle in his path to become the Democratic nominee.
When we look at who's in the race right now, back to the presidential race, Pete Buttigieg tends to be pegged as a more moderate candidate. Where do we see this in his policies?
I think one of the key examples of this would be his position on Medicare. A number of candidates like Elizabeth Warren advocate what they call Medicare for All, which essentially would eventually, after a certain time period, do away with the private insurance system. The mayor's plan is called Medicare for All Who Want It. So it would have that public option there. But for example, union members who have you know, spent dues and a considerable amount of time and negotiations for their health care plans would be able to keep those if they prefer. And so that is sort of a Goldilocks-like policy that's not too liberal, not too conservative that really seems to be resonating with voters. And a lot of Democratic voters, for them, healthcare is the number one issue. For voters on both sides of the aisle, healthcare is an important issue. And so that's one example. Another example is his position on college tuition. He would not give college tuition to families who earn over $100,000 a year. You know, someone like Elizabeth Warren would advocate that there should be no limit from a family's income on who gets public college tuition.
Some say Pete Buttigieg began the campaign with more progressive stances and has since pivoted into the moderate lane. Do you think he's changed his positions since being on the trail?
You know, one of the secret powers that he has as a candidate in the race is that he was a mayor in sort of a nonpartisan context where, yes, he had a D next to his name on the ballot when he ran for mayor in South Bend, but there aren't Republican or Democratic potholes. And, he sort of had to, contend with everyday issues like snow removal that aren't these politically charged, for the most part, obstacles. He instituted some roundabouts, which he had to expend some political capital on. But for the most part, he's able to kind of come in as this tabula rasa, this blank slate into the race without having all of these controversial Senate votes or, decisions as governor that he has piled up on his record. But for him, I think he benefits from that. But there's also sort of a drawback to it in instances like the South Bend police shooting that we saw this summer.
Pete Buttigieg is the first openly gay candidate to mount a major campaign for president. He's spoken about the hesitation he once had to be public about his sexuality and what that might have meant for his political career, particularly in Indiana. Now he's a contender in the Democratic field. Do you have a sense for the kind of impact his candidacy might have on the political landscape?
Well, we've already seen it here in Indiana to some extent. The first Democratic, gay gubernatorial candidate in Indiana, Josh Owens, a business executive here in the Indianapolis area, is running for governor. And, when I interviewed him, he acknowledged that Buttigieg's rise was one of the things that led him to believe that the time was right to mount that kind of historic campaign here in our own backyard. But, I think broadly beyond his sexuality, I think there are a lot of questions about what his meteoric rise means in Indiana politics. Does he have coattails down the ballot? Is some of that money that he has accrued for his presidential run, if he were to be unsuccessful, is that going to back other Indiana Democrats and advance the party statewide? Because as sort of anybody who follows Indiana politics know, the Democrats are in a bad place here. They don't hold any statewide office at the moment. And, I think Buttigieg is someone that has the power and the resources to change that if that's something he decides to do.
And say Pete Buttigieg secures the nomination, or maybe he finds himself on the ticket as vice president, perhaps. There are a few scenarios where Buttigieg could be running against Mike Pence, essentially. What do you imagine that race looks like?
Well, I think it's important to note that if you go back into March, Buttigieg was in the low single digits. He wasn't getting a lot of airtime in CNN town halls. And then all of a sudden, he got a CNN town hall of his own. And, ratings were off the charts. And he had sort of this famous moment where he attacked the vice president, Mike Pence, as a cheerleader for the porn star presidency. That moment went viral. It led to a surge in his donations. He eventually qualified for the first Democratic debate, in large part because of that appearance. And so he's really proven himself to be an able interlocutor of the vice president, sort of an attack dog. And so I think, for him, if some permutation happened where Vice President Pence was at the top of the ticket, Buttigieg's stock would rise considerably because of his ability to sort of contrast himself with another plainspoken Midwesterner, Hoosier. And I think that, that would be something that voters in a place like, Iowa or New Hampshire or even here in Indiana, if they happen to fall on the other side of the ideological divide, would say, look, I like this guy. I like that he knows Vice President Pence and can really prosecute the case against him.
We know that Pete Buttigieg is putting together a ground game in Indiana. Can you tell us what that looks like?
Yeah. So he, you know, had a presence in the state back in August at the annual French Lit Gathering of Democrats, the Indiana Democratic Editorial Association meeting. You know, he has a delegate director who's from Indiana who is working on, you know, helping him make inroads with superdelegates. But he also has a lot of Hoosiers working on the campaign who are helping him gather signatures right now. He needs a number of signatures to qualify for the ballot here, and he's working on that. He also has an Indiana state director, a hire that really raised a lot of eyebrows when it happened back in October, because it raised questions about whether or not he might be interested in perhaps running for governor in 2020 if the presidential run doesn't work out. As it turns out, the filing deadline for the Democratic nomination in Indiana for the gubernatorial race is just a few days after the Iowa caucuses. So it would be a bit of whiplash if he decided to do that. But he really does have an advantage in Indiana, which, as you know, back in 2016 during the Republican primary, had an outsized role in, settling on Trump as the nominee.
How much influence could Indiana potentially have in the 2020 race?
Well, I think recently, over the last couple of weeks, some factors have developed that make it more likely that Indiana will still be in play and the nomination will still be in play come next May. You have billionaires like Tom Steyer and Michael Bloomberg with vast sums of money up on the air already in Indiana, even though we don't vote until next May with ads. They are going to potentially prolong the nominating process. If we just go by polls today, which could change, it looks like the mayor would take Iowa. It looks like he might take New Hampshire, possibly contested by Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders there. And then in South Carolina, it looks like Joe Biden win, and so would win based on his support with African Americans. So it's possible that, we get through the first four nominating states and don't really have a candidate that is the titular front runner. And so, we could go to Super Tuesday and on Super Tuesday, because of the need for an air war and the resources that it takes to run ads nationwide, you could see someone like, Steyer or Bloomberg make a play there and really put the pressure financially on candidates like Joe Biden, who don't have vast sums of money to spend at this point in the nominating process. So I think Indiana could play a role, and it's possible. I've done some reporting that would suggest that the Buttigieg campaign is preparing for a contested convention.
Pete Buttigieg has proposed significant structural changes around the Electoral College and the Supreme Court. He argues that these institutions need to be restructured, or in the case of the Electoral College, abolished, to strengthen our democracy. Yet these are not topics we often hear too much about in the press. Why don't we hear more about these proposals?
These are two proposals that he spent a lot of time talking about earlier in the year when he first announced his exploratory committee. And they were, largely embraced by people on the left. He, as you alluded to earlier, does, get flack for not talking about those as much right now. But the truth is he's focused on Iowa and New Hampshire, where, those ideas get a little less traction or receive a little less welcome from sort of a moderate electorate. But those ideas could be pivotal. There doesn't seem to be sort of a political appetite from them right now from across the country. They will probably be used as attack ads should he get the nomination by Republicans. But they would give a state like Indiana, potentially more influence in the process. And so I think that, these signature ideas that he came out with, may be something that we hear less and less of as the nominating contest goes on. Until that is, you have places, like Washington, D.C. Vote, a liberal place where Democrats have a lot of power. He talks about statehood for D.C. I'm sure that would go over well there, and he could win a contest like that because of those ideas.
Adam Wren writes about Pete Buttigieg for Politico magazine. Adam, thanks for your time.
Good to be with you, Matt.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross and Chris Flood. Join us next time when we'll talk about safety culture at Amazon. A former safety inspector for Indiana says Governor Eric Holcomb and other state officials worked to shift blame away from Amazon
after a recent workplace death, hoping to avoid bad press while the state pursued the company's new headquarters. Holcomb says it didn't happen. We'll talk to the reporter behind the investigative report that broke the story. That's tomorrow. In the meantime, find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get podcasts. I'm Matt Pelzer. Thanks for listening. This is All In.